Welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
And I think just like tomatoes, faith comes in every shape and every size. I think that sometimes we think of faith as like this static thing, that we have faith once and for all, and that it's faith forever. And it always looks the same, and we always put it in the same spot. But really, we want to, through this series, work on the belief that it's not so much static as it is a daily posture of trust and surrender and obedience to Christ. And we're going to look through, again, the Gospel of Luke, which is what we've been working on through this year. And it really challenges us to examine where we place our security, how we steward what has been given to us, and what it truly means to be rich toward God. And I think the whole goal for this series, The Shape of Faith, is to not only be professed, but to be practiced. One that loosens its grip on fear and control and possessions and really tightens its grip on the promises of the kingdom. And I think we can better understand not only the shape of our faith, but to learn to shape our faith in different ways. That faith is going to show up in different ways in our lives and challenge us to live with open hands, expectant hearts, and a resilient hope in times of trouble. This morning, I'm going to preach on something that's not going to bring us a lot of happiness. It's going to hit us in a place that we're going to feel like, oof, that's speaking to me, and I don't know if I can do this anymore. This is a tough one, and it's going to be, there's not a lot of redemption in our modern lives from it. And we're going to try and find a way that our faith can meet us in this place. This is a parable that Jesus teaches in Luke 12, and it has a lot to do with faith, even though the word faith is not mentioned at all in this. So let's read Luke 12, 13 through 21. This is traditionally known as the parable of the rich fool. And it starts this way. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" Verse 15, then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." I mean, that's the whole thing right there, right? But then he doubles down and he tells this parable. "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." Many Americans struggle with clutter. We sang about it this morning. This is one of the reasons for the popularity and the simplicity movement, or why people get addicted to like reading Amish books, you know, a simple lifestyle. We want to just ditch our phone. We want to go to the lake. We want to, you know, live in a cabin in the woods. It's why books like Maria Kondo's The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up has become so popular. I own a copy. I don't think I've ever read it, but I do have a copy of it. Researchers from UCLA visited the homes of 32 typical Americans across the country. This was a nationwide study. They wanted to look at how people interacted with their environments, how they used their space. And so they went through each room, closet, and every shelf in the home and systematically documented everything, all the stuff that people owned. And so researcher Janine Arnold said, contemporary U.S. households have more possessions per household than any society in global history. Her colleague Anthony Grash notes that our homes reflect this material abundance. Hyper-consumerism is evident in many spaces, like garages and corners of home offices, and even sometimes in the corners of living rooms and bedrooms. The researchers continued, we have lots of stuff. We have many ways in which we accumulate possessions in our home, but we have few processes of getting rid of them. The United States has 3.1% of the world's children, but it consumes 40% of the world's toys. And things like Amazon have made it easier for us to just click and buy and get the next day. And we're within 5 miles of a Walmart somewhere in America at all times. And so this idea of hyper-consumerism, that we need to continue buying and buying and buying and make our lives full. And what does that lead to? More land sold to storage unit developers. Let's build a storage unit because people have so much stuff, they don't know what to do with it. And we can't park our cars in our garage because it's filled with stuff. Now, I'm not here to guilt you into stuff this morning. Because in fact, that's not what the parable is trying to do. We're going to look at what stuff does in our lives. And someone interrupts Jesus here about a stuff dispute. We have this stuff, and please someone tell me what to do with it. Except that's not what he asks, is it? What if our deepest concerns are rooted not in what we lack, but in what we cling to? I want to introduce you to this metaphor of the barn versus the bowl. And so in this story, in this parable, we have a barn. We have a structure of accumulation. It stores, it safeguards resources in the belief that it will make us more secure. It's massive, it's heavy, it's closed off, and it's always expandable, but it's never really satisfied. And again, it's going to feel like I'm attacking barns today, but I'm not. Don't tear down your barns. Don't tear down your storage units. It's going to feel a lot like that, but don't. That's not where my heart's coming from today. But let's look at the metaphor of a bowl. It's a vessel of sufficiency, not abundance. A bowl holds what we need for the moment. It's small, it's opened, it's shared, it's passed around the table. It teaches us contentment and humility and community. A rich man builds barns, but the disciple holds a bowl. The barn isolates, but the bowl invites. The barn swells with ego, but the bowl opens with faith. The barn is a trap disguised as a blessing, and the bowl is a blessing disguised as simplicity. This is a parable about the accumulation trap, about what accumulation does to us and for us and because of us and in spite of us. The wealthy die despite their riches, the psalm taught us. The man wants fairness, but Jesus warns about greed, not about injustice. The parable shows a man talking only to himself, not to God, not to neighbors. How should I use my wealth? I know, I'll close it off. I'll store it for myself. What should I do? I have no place. I will tear down. I will store. I will say to myself. This reminds me of a really old saying that possessions are their own punishment. You see, because possessions in us create this false security. The man in the parable thinks that his wealth will protect him from worry or suffering or death. But his sense of control is really an illusion, and that illusion itself becomes the trap. This accumulation trap. His possessions don't solve anything. They simply delay his awareness of his spiritual poverty. It's like the more he had, the more he was convinced he became that he didn't need God. And you know, that's fine to accumulate things. The accumulation is not the problem. We put our money into stocks and mutual funds. We put away for a rainy day. We put into savings accounts. And sometimes we accumulate things that have memories attached to them, things that belong to our kids when they were younger, or things that belonged to our parents, things that have been passed down. These things are not necessarily wrong. But it's when we start to put our security in them, when we start to believe, you know what, I don't need other things to keep me safe. I have my barn. This is the accumulation trap. Possessions demand more from us than they give. The rich man builds bigger barns, not a simpler life. His wealth doesn't free him. He doesn't believe that if I just gave everything away, I would be freer. He believes that if I have more wealth, if I accumulate more things, then I will be safe. I will be free. That'll free me up for so many things. But it enslaves him to upkeep and protection and expansion and anxiety. And we might say it like this: the things we own eventually own us. Really, the punishment is the burden of management and maintenance and fear. And I think sometimes possessions can numb us to eternity, that instead of preparing for the eternal, it prepares us to be at ease. It prepares us to be comfortable. It prepares us to just go through life smoothly. But as we see in that Colossians that we read and the Psalm that we read and even in Ecclesiastes, death renders all earthly possessions as meaningless. His punishment isn't just losing it all. His punishment is that it was never used for anything that mattered. It was stored like in a reservoir. It wasn't pushed down the river. It was put into a barn and kept and stored for himself. It wasn't put into a bowl and passed out. The wealth he idolized ended up distracting him from what he truly needed. I think that possessions also dull our generosity. There's no mention in this parable of neighbors or community or gratitude in his plan. Only self-preservation. And self-preservation, when we look out for number one and never forget your number, that's when we start to have trouble with generosity. Generosity never comes in this accumulation trap. His possessions really isolated him. And so in that sense, the self-centered nature of his abundance becomes its own prison. He was rich in things, but he was poor in relationships and generosity and this eternal mindset. So I think that a lot of times accumulation looks like wisdom. I think that accumulation masquerades as wisdom, but it leads to anxiety and isolation and spiritual blindness. We are blinded by all those things because we just want more and we want to hold them. This is a church that doesn't believe in accumulating people. We believe in sending people. This is not a big barn church. This is a bowl church. where we say we have what we have now and we're content with that. And we want to give to the community out of that bowl, not out of our barns. Jesus doesn't criticize the man in the parable for stealing or exploiting or defrauding. There's no indication that he made money unethically. In fact, it was likely the result of his honest labor or favorable circumstance. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, putting that stuff in the barn is not the problem. The problem was the self-preservation. It was his spiritual imagination. He believed that wealth could secure his future. It could soothe his soul. I have all of his stuff. Now let's eat, drink, and be merry. Have you heard that phrase before? That's actually from the Bible. It's repeated in the Old Testament and the New Testament, except it's wrong, isn't it? The proverb is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And the rich man said, let's eat, drink, and be merry because now my barns are full and I can have a life of ease. And God says, you forgot something. Tomorrow you die. You forgot the one big thing is that you can't comfort yourself with your possessions. You can't be liberated from your anxiety and your fear if you're going to control everything in your life. If you think that a full barn gives you control, you're wrong. If you think that a full barn means that you can eat, drink, and be merry, you're wrong because your life is now demanded of you. And so who gets what you have accumulated? And so those men arguing about the inheritance were asking the wrong questions from the very beginning. He believed his money could do what only God can do. He trusted it to secure his soul, to write his future, to give him rest. It's not how he made it. It's what he made it mean. He idolized it. What you give your time and effort to, that's your God, by the way. What you worship, what you bring into your life and put front and center, what you rest on, what you give control in your life, that's your God. And so the rich fool says, my God is a full barn. The thing I give my trust and control to, the thing that I cherish most, the thing that I worship, the thing that gives me peace and ease, the thing that allows me to eat, drink, and be merry, a full barn. This is what Jesus calls foolishness, not the means of gain, but the meaning the man assigned to it. What do you believe your money can do for you? What do you believe your accomplishments can do for you? What do you believe your plans can do for you? And what if you're wrong about that? What if you're just waiting for, you know, God, if I just had a little bit more money, I could live free. You know, God, if I just had a little bit more time, or if all of my plans were working toward fruition. But what if you're wrong? What if a little bit more time doesn't make you happy? What if a little bit more money doesn't help you live free? God speaks the word no one else will say, and that's fool. God interrupts this with divine clarity and brutal honesty. You know, this is the only parable where God directly speaks to a person in it. And he calls him a fool. He gets one line in all the parables Jesus teaches, and it's fool. You fool. What are you after? Now, in Scripture, a fool isn't unintelligent. It's someone who lives as if there's no God. We read in the psalm, the fool says, I have years ahead, and God says, you only have hours. You made long-term plans for a short-term life. The Greek phrase, your soul will be required of you, is a financial and legal implication. It means there's a debt that's being called in. His life, like ours, is on loan. It's not owned. He built barns to keep his grain and his wealth and his plans, forgetting that his soul wasn't even his. His mistake wasn't wealth itself. It was thinking he was in control of time and future and self. You made all your plans around what you owned, but you forgot you didn't even own yourself. You don't belong to this world. And if you want to make money your God, then that's your choice. That's what you can do. If you want to make your sins your God, that's your choice. That's the way you can live. He built a future that would never come, and in doing so, he missed the presence of God. Because this is the tragedy of unused treasure. Accumulated treasure never fulfills its imagined purpose. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? We buy all this stuff, and then it just sits, and there's no intention, there's no purpose, and then it just is squandered. That's stewardship. God said, here's a church. God said, here's faith. God said, here's all these talents. Here's all this time and money and effort that I'm giving you. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to hold it for yourself? There's a lot of parables about holding things for ourselves rather than using the talents that God has given us. There's a parable of the talents. I went and made tenfold. I went and made fivefold. Well, I knew you were harsh, so I buried it under the ground. I didn't want to waste it. I put it in a barn and I locked it away, and no one gets to see it or use it. And here it is again for you. Here's my faith, God. I stewarded my faith well. I'll hand it right back to you. Thank you for giving me faith. Here it is. I didn't touch it. I didn't use it. I didn't grow it. I didn't give it to anyone else. I didn't want it to get dirty. Here it is. I kept it in a big barn and I locked the door and I didn't go out there to visit it at all. I didn't share it with my friends or my family or my community. I was a faithful servant, God. Here it is. Here's my faith back. I did well with it. You can lose your life in an instant, but even worse, you can waste it slowly, believing you're safe because your barn is full, because I have my faith. I'm safe. I have my faith. And we slowly leech it away because we don't practice it. We don't give it away. We don't use it for anyone else. The man wasn't dishonest, he wasn't unjust, he didn't exploit others. His sin wasn't how he made money, but what he believed it could do for him. He believed wealth could secure his soul, satisfy all his desires, stretch his time. But money cannot buy peace, it cannot guarantee joy or extend breath. And that belief, that false gospel, is what made him a fool. So what do we believe our possessions can do for us? How many of us are building barns in our lives, not with wood and nails, but with bank accounts, with digital security, with backup plans, with isolation, with imagined futures? Again, we should plan for the future, right? We don't want to run out of money. But are we putting our faith in that? Are we believing that our possessions, that our bank accounts, that our barns, as they get fuller and fuller, are doing something, are bringing us peace and joy that they cannot bring? What if the thing we're trusting to free us is actually the thing enslaving us? He didn't need a bigger barn, he needed an open bowl. So here's a few things that we can do for ourselves and for each other. First thing is that we need to understand that letting go isn't loss. It's liberation. A man in the parable thought security would come from storing more, but Jesus teaches that peace comes from trusting deeper. The kingdom is not built on barns, but on a bounty freely given by a generous God. In verse 32 of Luke 12 there, he goes on, he says, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." It really reframes everything for us. Peace doesn't come from possession, but it comes from proximity to the Father. How close are we getting to Jesus? We put our hope not in possessions, but in proximity. Faithful release actually means more. When we can let go of things, it isn't reckless, it isn't irresponsible. It's holding loosely to what we've been given. It's practicing generosity instead of hoarding. It's trusting God for the next step instead of obsessing over every scenario. It's living today with peace instead of building imaginary futures out of anxiety. You don't need to build your own kingdom when the Father is giving you His. The second thing we need to really absorb is that peace comes from trust, not control. Many people think more wealth will finally give them peace. But wealth always asks for more. More insurance, more management, more defense. Jesus offers the paradox in this parable. You find peace when you stop trying to manufacture it. You find peace when you give up your pursuit of building it. Real peace is the fruit of trust, not the product of control. Ooh. We got to stop there for a second. Real peace is the fruit of trust, not the product of control. And if you think controlling your world will bring you peace, let me know how that goes for you. A clenched fist can't hold anything else. A closed hand creates tension, but an open hand can give and receive. An open bowl is vulnerable and it is blessed. It receives what it needs daily and passes it along in community. It isn't afraid of being empty because it trusts in daily provision. And it's really a call to a new identity. What does it mean to be rich toward God? It means you live in relationship, not self-sufficiency. You define success by faithfulness, not accumulation. You orient your life around kingdom priorities, not personal security. And you use your resources to bless, not to build barns. Jesus doesn't shame wealth. He doesn't make the guy feel guilty for building a barn. But when he built a barn, he needed a bull. He exposes when we worship the barn. The barn is a monument to fear, but the bull is a witness to faith. Peace overflows from the bull, not the barn. There's one more thing, though. I think the real problem started at the very beginning. I think the problem in this story begins even before the parable, with the man who doesn't ask for wisdom. He doesn't ask for discernment. He doesn't ask for God. He doesn't ask for Jesus to come in and counsel him on this decision. He demands that Jesus affirms his agenda. That's the problem when we want God to bless our will. When we want God to affirm the things that we're doing. It reminds me of Mary and Martha. When Jesus shows up in the house and she goes to him and says, hey, tell my sister that she should start working. And he's like, you're asking the wrong question. You're asking me to bless your agenda when here's the reality is that I can't bless either one of you. So the man doesn't say, Jesus, help us solve this problem. Give me wisdom in this. Give me understanding in this. Jesus, help me discern the way forward in my inheritance with my brother. He doesn't say that. He says, tell my brother what to do. This is a one-sided request. It's not a question. He's not looking for truth. He's seeking leverage. And how often in our lives do we do that to Jesus? How often in our lives do we go to God and say, I'm not looking for you to change my mind, God. I want you to bless my endeavors. Here's my plan for the future. Will you please bless it? This man wasn't asking what God wanted. He was asking God to enforce what he wanted. And we've all done that, let's be honest. We call it prayer, but it's actually pressure. We say we want guidance, but what we really want is a rubber stamp. There's no prayer, there's no counsel, there's no surrender. It's just self-talk, self-interest, and self-direction. And this is what happens when you stop asking God to shape your life and you start asking him to sign off on your blueprint. Learning to ask God to shape your life. Learning to ask God to shape your faith. When was the last time you truly asked God what he wanted to do with what you've been given? Or have you already decided? And I think that affects us here as a church as well. Maybe we've already decided what we want God to do with this church. Maybe we've already decided the things that should be accomplished with this church. God, come to our church and bless all of our endeavors. God, this is a church. It should be doing things that we want it to do. And then we get years and years and years down the road and we say, I wonder why God isn't blessing this church. I wonder why God isn't blessing my faith. I wonder why God isn't growing me and stretching me and challenging me. It's because you've asked him to bless the plan you wrote rather than asking him to shape your life. This trouble starts when we stop listening and we start telling. What is God calling you to release, to make space for today? How can we trust in the bull and not the barn? Maybe it's control over your money. Maybe it's fear about the future. Maybe it's the assumption that more equals safe. But there is something. There's something that's in the way that we've made the path forward.